Welcome to American Variety Radio. My guest this week is a woman who's a singer, songwriter, and guitarist who's based in Southwest Florida, around Naples, kind of the stretch between Naples and Chokoloskee, I guess, and who's really made a mission of writing and singing about the Everglades and the people who live in it or used to live in and around it, and kind of just the whole world that the shrinking Everglades represents. Her name is Cindy Hackney. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm glad you're here. And she's, I guess, what I would call an Everglades balladeer. Cindy is well known in Southwest Florida for a genre that she kind of invented, which she calls sawgrass music, right? So take off maybe on bluegrass music. But she plays acoustic guitar. And as I said, as a singer-songwriter. And I first read about Cindy in an issue of Florida Fish and Wildlife News last fall. In fact, let me just read kind of the excerpt of their little article about Cindy. They said, inspired by wild and grassroots Florida, Cindy Hackney composes and performs songs about the breathtaking beauty of the Everglades environment, local culture, and the heartbreaking loss to both to rapid development. But you're not a native Floridian then, you're from...
I'm from Pennsylvania. I come from several hundred years of Quaker heritage, folks that came in the 1680s and pretty much farmed off the land in Pennsylvania. So I always had a passion for the woods and the wild. But I came, to visit parents who bought a place on the beach in Naples in 1986, fell in love with it and stayed. And then I met a man who was born and raised in Naples, fourth generation, just gotten out of the military about a month after I got here, and I fell in love with him and the environment.
Well, that's a good combination. So you consider yourself a Florida girl now?
Well, I married a cracker, and I didn't even know what one was before.
Uh-huh.
And I have to explain that to Northerners constantly, even my own relatives who think it's some derogatory name. And I tell them it's a form of pride for a native of Florida.
Yeah, that's right.
Who has some deep connections to the land.
We just had a young woman on who's a documentary filmmaker living in New York City, but she was born in Florida and describes herself as a cracker, Haley Downs, and... I guess we were talking then in that show about that phenomenon that particularly to African Americans, cracker is a term, it means kind of a racist, it's mm-hmm. sort of equivalent to a redneck in a way, but as you say, it's an old term going back deep into Florida history that has a cultural resonance. It really just means the original rural European settler people who came down into Florida, right? So I guess you're a cracker by marriage, huh?
Right, and I don't think my husband even really understood what a cracker was, but being an eco-tour guide, I have to explain this. And, there were Florida cowboys that were probably actually instrumental in that name because they followed those great cattle herds with those long whips, and that
right.
was the cracker sound.
Yep. Yeah, I forgot to say that. I thought everybody knew that since they all listened to my show. Well, you've had two CDs out, Cindy, right? One is called Gator in a Slough.
Mm-hmm.
And one called My Florida, right?
So, correct. Mm-hmm.
So, I described at the outset your new genre called sawgrass.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play a couple of tracks here in the show, but why don't you describe to me what your music is about rather than me describe it?
Okay, well, all my life I've written music, but after several years of being here in Florida, I've just felt a passion for... what seems so endangered, these very special places that I knew around Collier County. Within 20 miles of me, I have about five different wilderness areas, from the Picayune and Fakahatchee to the Big Cypress Preserve. And I also met a lot of folks that lived in these areas and had deep roots. And hanging out with them and hanging out in the wild, I was inspired to write certain songs, based on the content that's connected to their stories and the stories of the land, but also... I felt that something like bluegrass, but a little more laid back and a little quieter and done with the bare hand instead of, with picks, kind of represented that landscape and mm-hmm. those people, and I called that sawgrass.
Okay. We're going to play a track from your first CD called Gator in a Slough. And I should say, to those who don't know, a slough in this case is spelled S-L-O-U-G-H, which is like the word slough. But this is English for you, and a slough is really what a really muddy, thick, swampy area.
A slough is the center of a strand, and a strand is usually a hardwood forest. But it's the central part that is carrying water, from a higher elevation to a lower elevation, which in our case in the Everglades might be from 10 feet to 3 feet.
Okay, so it's not anyway, spelled S-L-E-W, like a whole slew of things to do today or something.
it's a slewy slough,
so
yes.
It's a gator in a slough. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to play the third cut on that CD, which is called Strong Tonight.
See a shooting star, it burns across the center of my sky. Live a simple life, I pledge a simple creed, and I ain't got no use for things that don't come naturally from the bottom of my heart.
Beautiful. So that was called Strong Tonight. Is that sort of characteristic of a lot of your music, sort of sweet, soft ballad, or does it range a lot?
I think that I started out writing a lot of sweet ballads, and actually when I started to play out more, you know, I had people looking like they're falling asleep on me, or people that really wanted to hear something that they could listen to without listening very deeply, and I think then I started writing some faster songs like Gator in a Slough and Everglades Folk and some others. But I like those kind of songs because my kind of passion is a more quiet passion, I think, than a than a dancing passion.
Sounded pretty to me.
Thank you.
You're listening to American Variety. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Cindy Hackney, who is a singer-songwriter from Southwest Florida, kind of based out of Naples, but somebody who makes a lot of forays into the Everglades on her own and as an echo tour guide. We're going to talk about that a little later, but primarily we're talking with her about her entertainment and her her musical part of her life. Why don't you tell us, Cindy, about the process of making and performing your music? Like, how and when do you write songs? Do you write a lot in a burst, or do you just do it occasionally, or do you wake up in the middle of the night, or how does that work?
I have times when I feel more creative, and it has to also do with my workload, where I'm spending my time. But, you know, I live in a semi-rural area, and I do a lot of walking in the woods with my dogs, and that's one of my best places for writing music. And also when I'm driving, mostly in rural areas, and I have, you know, hours on the road, and I get into that zone where things happen and you're not really planning them to happen. And so I usually get a tune and a first verse kind of at the same time, and so it takes me a little longer to write second and third verses, but usually I get enough of the song kind of in that subconscious realm that I know it's going to finish eventually within maybe a few days.
But you usually, you don't come up with the words and music simultaneously, right? Do you come up with a lyric?
I would say, yeah, a few lines come simultaneously, and that's, you're usually not quite paying attention, and you realize you have a couple lines, you know, verse and lyric and tune. And then you say, then you'll start to work on it a little harder, but it comes naturally after that.
Do you carry a tape recorder with you wherever you go?
I've tried that before, but then you see, I think that your brain and your experience will naturally weed out the stuff that's pretty meaningless and not very strong. When you tape things, then you start to tape everything, and you can't discern between what's really meaningful and what isn't. So I like to let it happen. If I forget it the next day, then that wasn't a song.
I was going to ask. I mean, if you got, you know, you're driving 40 miles, by the time you get where you're going, you may have forgotten what you thought about, or at least I would have.
No, that's why I say when you get the tune with the lyric, then it's, you remember it really well. If you only had a tune, you might not remember it, but something about words and a tune together is very, you remember that very well.
Listening to your CDs, most of them, if not all, seem to have an environmental message really focused around the Everglades. Would you say that that's true, that nearly all of them do, or do you kind of range across other messages in your songs?
Well, you know, I think like most people, I think, based on what I know of other friends that are songwriters, because you start hanging out with other songwriters, you know, you write about your experience, and that's what works best. If you try to reach too far into somebody else's experience, you don't do as well. And so I do write about other experiences that don't have to do with the Everglades, but what works for my CDs and for what I play out is usually this Florida passion of mine. But, you know, I write about other places I travel to, some more human, non-Everglades oriented, but this is what I'm known for, and so this is kind of what I've carried on in a broad kind of package of Everglades music.
What about live performance? Do you do a lot of that?
You know, I do a lot of. There's times a year when I do tours, I try to do little concerts for the people that I'm touring around in the Everglades. Also, places like Chokoleski, there's times a year when I'll play there several times. And I'm really a campfire singer, though. You know, when we go out camping and invite a lot of their friends, we sit around the campfire and we play, and so that's how I started. So, yeah, I do environmental gigs a lot, especially Earth Day and fundraisers for different preserves and for environmental organizations. So that kind of stuff. I'm not a bar player. I have played bars, but, sure. But you know, most people at the bar don't really want to listen. And my music really demands some listening. It's not a casual. It's a little bit engaging.
Do you do concerts at some level sometimes?
Well, and I do folk festivals. You know, the Florida Folk Festival every year. I usually am there playing up in White Springs, which is Memorial Day weekend, and. Other festivals I occasionally do, but sometimes I can't because of work. So the kind of concerts I normally do other than festivals are put on by, like, the water management or something, where they'll have several hundred people come to a kind of a learning and educational festival on some aspect of conservation, and then I'll be set up to play in a little amphitheater or something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're the sideline entertainment for a more educational forum or something, huh?
Yeah, but usually they give me pretty good play. I mean, I really like that relationship because it's nothing fluffy. It's like the real thing, and I'm kind of singing to the choir, but I'm also hoping to get some people that are new in the Everglades and don't really understand it.
Well, it reinforces what they're there to do educationally anyway, and so it's a good match, I suppose.
It's exactly true. It reinforces what they're learning in a way that won't hit them over the head with it, with the information. It'll kind of seep in, I hope.
So you mentioned your other work. And I know from reading about you, and you mentioned earlier, too, that you're an ecotourism guide. Is that the work you do, or are those, or do you have another day job?
Well, I started pretty much as a journalist and a photojournalist, freelancing, which is so tough, you know, when I came here. And then worked for a small paper called the Everglades Echo for 3 years, and that's where I got a lot of my material. And that was from 95 to 98, and then back again in 2000, 2001. But after that, I had a friend that I had met through an article that I had done on Friends of the Fakahatchee, which was a new organization to try to make the Fakahatchee more known around Florida. And he started an ecotourism business and asked me to do day trips, and then he asked me to do week-long trips also. So that's become my main, even though it's pretty much just about 6 months of the year, that's my main job, really.
Wow, week-long trips. So
yeah,
these are
6 and 7 day trips.
Yeah. So is it pretty, pretty no frills, or are you providing, you know, all the modern conveniences you can possibly provide out on a trip like that? What's
pretty,
it like?
Pretty much we are, because it's for Elder Hostel, and so these are active outdoor seniors, people 55 and over. But you know, they're anything from birding tours to manatee encounters, snorkel trips to the Keys, some historical trips between the Everglades and the Tortugas. So do a variety of things, but yes, they're staying in motels at night.
Oh, okay. That's what I was going to ask. You're not out in the Fakahatchee for a week straight in a pup tent with them.
No, I've done some of those kind of things, but not with my tourists.
Just with your friends and your family.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, tell us some stories about some of your adventures out back in Florida, Cindy. What have you run
man,
into that's
so
interesting?
Many. You know, I'm very fortunate that where I live, in the Big Cypress Basin, rural suburban Florida, that I get to pretty much engage with all kinds of native wildlife, you know, on a regular basis. But I would say probably it's those first experiences you have when you come to a place that stick in your mind. Mm. And my, you know, of course, everybody wants to see a Florida panther. Well, the first one I saw, I didn't even really know what they were. It was about 21 years ago. And I had just covered, as a photographer, the swamp buggy races in Naples. And a National Geographic photographer had, who was working on a long-term assignment, said, "Can you keep my camera equipment for a month?" It was like $20,000 worth of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I said, "I'm going to go up to Sanibel to Ding Darling and take some pictures of birds, because I've got this 600 millimeter with a coupler and all this." So I go up there, and I'm the first person in the morning. It's around 6 a.m. before sunrise, and I'm the first person going in, and there weren't crowds at Ding Darling back then, and I'm waiting for this electric eye to raise the bar on this, you know, at sunrise to go into this place. And I see this large animal about 75 feet in front of my car on the other side of this little gate. And I thought, what is that? No, don't tell me that's... And so I got out of the car, I go up to the gate, and I go in front of the gate, and this animal stops, and we look at each other for about 3 or 4 seconds, which is a long time when you know, with a wild animal.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, that is Florida panther. There's the kink in its tail.
Long tail
kink in it, you know, like they sit towards the end because of genetic inbreeding. And we looked at each other like, and then it just kind of jogged off. And that was just one of those moments when, wow, he recognized me and I recognized him and nobody else was around.
I saw one when I was 15 and was hunting on the ranch owned by some friends of my parents, west of Fort Pierce, and it was actually in the middle of the night, and I think the statute of limitations has expired. I was jacklighting, and I had basically a miner's headlamp on my head and a shotgun, and I was 15 years old, right? And so I saw what I thought was, I was hunting for deer, but I saw two big golden eyes in a cane break across a field. I was in an open field, but it was you know, ringed by palmettos and cane, and so I thought, well, gee, I don't know, that looks like weird. Maybe it's a cow. The eyes were too big and too gold, you know, and I didn't want to shoot a cow, obviously, so I walked closer and closer, and I got about maybe 15 to 20 feet away, and this thing screamed like a woman, just this blood-curdling scream that just parted my hair. I mean, and I took that for about 3 seconds. I mean, the cane was literally shaking. I could see the bushes moving. It was screaming so loud and it was moving the air. I turned and ran. I bet I covered the first 100 yards in under 9 seconds. I don't even remember what I did with the gun. It was, you know, I threw it and ran. And I jumped an irrigation ditch, and I don't think I quit running for about a quarter mile. I was scared to death.
There weren't many panthers back then, so that was really a great sighting.
It was rare and unexpected, and scared the heck out of me. I don't think I slept all night anyway, because we were sleeping way out in the bush, you know. So,
oh no, that's a great story.
I remember it very vividly, even though it was quite a number of years ago. Well, let's see. So, any other stories?
Well, you know, some of them are more flora driven, and some more fauna. But one really neat trip I had about 9 years ago. Working at the Everglades Echo, I got to know the biologists for different public lands, and so I cover stories about these guys, and they were talking about going on a two-night, three-day orchid and bromeliad identification count in the central slough of the Fakahatchee. And nobody had done this. No biologists had done this for 25 years. It had been done once before by the original biologist that worked there in the 60s, or actually it would have been 30-some years. So I volunteered to go on this, and I was going to be the photographer for the group. And we had to carry all our gear and our food and what we're going to sleep in, everything on our backs. And we had to walk with this stuff, you know, to the location we're going to sleep that night and then the next day. So we couldn't, like, leave anything anywhere. So I had the camera on a monopod for my walking stick also, had a pack on my back with some food. We had tablets to purify water, things like that. And there were just three women and I think five or six men. And that was the most incredible trip because it took us a half a day just to get to the central slough, you know, hiking. And this was in March, about 9 years ago. And, you know, at times we had water even then up to our waist. And we slept in hammocks at night. And it was incredible. I learned so much about really wild and endangered orchids and bromeliads and saw things. We saw some ferns, which are the largest fern in North America. You see them through South Florida and Central Florida, and that is the leather fern. Well, we saw them 12 feet high, and the highest recorded ones ever before were 11 feet high. So there were so many mysteries in there that people didn't know, and more of certain than ferns and things than the biologists even thought still existed, and then less of others. And it was just an incredible. We were swallowed up in the wild, and you know, it was just neat.
That sounds amazing. I was going to ask you, have you ever seen a ghost orchid?
Yeah, I have a song about that.
Classic song. Classic question, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and I also, I have a song called The Power of the Ghost, and it's based on being so addicted to seeing more of them once you find one that I got myself and my friend Valerie lost in the Fakahatchee about 5 years ago. And it took my husband, who didn't even know where we were. It was my birthday, and so we thought, why isn't she back for dinner? We were going to have a special dinner, and he came and saw the car parked, and within about 15 minutes, he found us, and we could not find our way out of the swamp. So I said, there you go. Cracker just kind of knows the swamp, even my husband, who had never been there.
Well, you were just bedazzled. But, I mean, for those of us, those who don't know, the ghost orchid is, I guess, a very rare, beautiful, white, fairly large orchid.
Yeah.
I guess maybe a very large orchid.
Yeah, very large, actually.
That was the subject of a book called The Orchid Thief a few years back, which then was made into a movie, adapted into a movie called Adaptation, which a lot of people may have seen.
Which has nothing really to do with ghost orchid. It's kind of a...
Yeah.
But it's one of those orchids that, the Fakahatchee Preserve is considered the orchid capital of the United States.
Hmm.
We have about 200 native orchids in the United States. Almost 50 of them grow right in the Fakahatchee, which is only 80,000 acres. Imagine that, a quarter of all the orchids in the whole United States growing in the Fakahatchee.
Wow.
The reason is that the sloughs in the Fakahatchee are a little bit deeper than anywhere else in the greater Everglades, so it's a little more humid in there, very dense swamp with those cypress trees. So you've got temperatures that are a little more humid and a little warmer in some places than anywhere else in the Everglades. So tropicals that come, you know, spores that come on hurricanes from the south survive there better than other places. So that's why you've got such rare orchids that aren't found almost at no other places in the United States.
I see. I never knew that. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Everglades balladeer and adventuress Cindy Hackney, who is a singer-songwriter based down in the Naples-Chokoloskee area of southwest Florida. We're talking about her adventures in the Everglades. I'll tell you what, Cindy, why don't we play another tune off of your Gator in a Slough CD. This one's called Help Us Save the Everglades.
Great.
Who's playing that beautiful harmonica?
I'm glad you asked that. That is the most recorded harmonica player in the world. I was very fortunate to get him. That's Charlie McCoy, music director from Hee Haw. But he's played with everybody from Elvis to George Michael. And he happened to be a friend of a friend of the guy that owned the studio where I recorded that CD, and he played for me for $50 a song. He actually winters in Fort Myers. And when he's not in Nashville, and he was just he was wonderful. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, good guy to know. I think he plays on several songs on that CD, huh?
Yeah, he plays. He carried a lot of that CD at a time when we weren't sure where it was going. But no, what a great guy, and he's so helpful. And yeah, I love to hear him play. He's an angel when he plays.
I can tell, Cindy. We've just played a couple of tracks from one of your CDs. This one called "Gator in a Slough," but you actually have a newer one out called "My Florida," which I would be playing something from, except that I'm afraid I would confuse myself in switching CDs here and forget to keep talking. But where can people buy your CDs? For example, "Gator in a Slough," and then the newer one called "My Florida."
Well, "Gator in a Slough," you can get online. You can look up Florida Wildlife Federation's site and look at their store, and you can buy my "Gator in a Slough" from them, and then they benefit also. So it's great for helping save Florida, actually. And then also Clyde Butcher, who I play at his gallery every year for Labor Day for their swamp walk, he carries the "My Florida," and the proceeds from that, some of that goes to help Friends of the Big Cypress Preserve. So you can go online and contact him for that CD.
Okay, so I actually asked you that question earlier, and I looked up the websites, and I'm going to give those for our listeners. The "Gator in a Slough" can be gotten from the Florida Wildlife Federation website, as Cindy said, which is fwfonline.org. Okay, so like Florida Wildlife Federation, fwfonline.org. And then "My Florida," which has also got a lot of beautiful South Florida-oriented songs on it, is from Clyde Butcher's site, which is www.clydebutcher.com. So that's CLYDEBUTCHER.com, clydebutcher.com. Well, you know, we've been talking about and around the Everglades, but we read in the paper, you know, about the Everglades Restoration Project, and we kind of all generally know that the Everglades used to be this giant river of grass that's now greatly shrunken from what it once was due to development and farming and the sugarcane industry and cutting of the water flow southward from the Okeechobee, Lake Okeechobee. So I don't know, is even the entire Everglades National Park still Everglades, or is it all shrunken even within those boundaries?
Well, I would say Everglades National Park is still the Everglades. I would say that just the Everglades are compromised based on hydrology changes, chemical changes, development on the outskirts. Fortunately, if we can change hydrology, improve that to a more natural flow, then we can bring a lot of the Everglades back or make it less compromised. Because, you know, I think as scientists have studied South Florida, I think they basically now think of the greater Everglades as the Kissimmee River corridor south to Okeechobee and then basically Okeechobee south. But there is not a connection anymore because of drainage and filling of areas, you know, starting in the late 1800s, actually, around Okeechobee, all the way up to the 50s when the Corps put in so many canals in the Everglades. So you don't have that connection mainly from what we think of as the lungs and the heart of the Everglades, which is Okeechobee, to the lower sloughs and river of grass. So I look at this possibility of buying out of maybe several hundred acres of sugarcane production and returning that to natural vegetation, and then maybe getting a flow in there from Okeechobee in some areas, actually down into the Everglades from Okeechobee. And then we would have a possibility of actually really restoring the greater Everglades. I think that's the most important thing we can do.
Cindy, I wish we had more time to talk about the Everglades and more time to listen to more of your songs, but we are out of time, and I want to thank you for being on with us today.
Thank you so much. I love the Everglades, and I just would like to spark that interest in others that live down here in Florida and see how vital it is for our happiness, our well-being in Florida, to protect them.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.